Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer and historian John Meacham talks about his latest book, American Struggle, Democracy, Dissent, and the Pursuit of a More Perfect Union. It was published by Random House in February of this year, and in this episode, the first of a two-part special, John Meacham was interviewed by fellow biographer and Bio member John, better known as Jack, Farrell.
Welcome to Bio.
Thank you, sir.
And thank you so much for your help over the years. I wanted to begin by talking about a symposium that Bio conducted last spring in Montgomery, Alabama. And as the sort of the token Washingtonian there, I was asked to give a report on what was happening. And I said, this is going to be far worse than the first 4 years. And we're probably going to have to go out to the streets, inspired somewhat by the fact that looking out the window, you could see the exact spot where Rosa Parks was arrested. And then David Greenberg, a biographer of John Lewis, stood up and said, well, going to the streets is one thing, but I would urge you all to stay true to your craft, stay true to your art. That's what you can contribute, very importantly, to the conversation. This new book seems to be a great melding of the two, but I wanted to ask you, what is the role of a writer, an artist, historian, biographer in politics in times like this?
It's a great question. And I predictably will take an Anglican response and agree with both you and David. So I go back to one of the best definitions of a writer I ever encountered, which is in a letter from Shelby Foote to Walker Percy. You can tell where I grew up. Foote wrote that the first duty of a writer is to teach people how to see. I've always loved that, to teach people how to see. And I am very much part, I don't want to drag you into this, but I think you are too, very much part of what Justice Holmes called the passionate action of the time. I don't think that has to be your one's primary goal, but it's inextricably bound up in my mind with what I'm supposed to do. I'm incredibly fortunate. I'm one of the luckiest practitioners of this, of my generation. I believe that to whom much is given, much is expected. And I've done three books that were immediately born out of the moment. They've all been informed by it, right? Perhaps overly facile image I sometimes use is, I believe that biographers and historians have to paint true portraits, but we paint by the light that streams in the window. And so we see things.
I like that one.
Good, I got one. And so so 25 years ago, I did a book on religious liberty and the American civic religious tradition, based on a moment in the first decade of the century where you had a rising secularist movement, you know, the new atheism, the Hitchens, Dawkins world, you may remember. And you also had a kind of Christian nationalist fundamentalist theme going. And so I wanted to step in, and explicitly because of that moment, I wanted to argue that you can't take religion entirely out of politics. You just have to manage it and marshal it. And then 13 years later, I guess, in the wake of Charlottesville in 2017, I sat down and wrote a book called The Soul of America, which argued that there have been moments in our past where the politics of hope and fear have been existentially pitted against each other. And just barely we've gotten out on the hopeful side, but it's been a damn close run thing, as Wellington said. And this book, which is an anthology of, I believe, the kinds of voices that can remind us that nothing has been easy and we have prevailed, but we've only prevailed if we've really, really spent the toil of heart and mind to do it. And so I would not go to the streets, I don't think.
I think you would at one point.
Well, I feel an obligation of citizenship. I mean, my view basically is, if somebody like me isn't going to spend capital in a moment like this, when the hell are we? You know, and it's not comfortable.
Did you get a bad reaction among some of your fans when it came out that you were writing speeches for President Biden?
You know, it's a great question. I did get from people I admire the reaction, we thought you were neutral. And I was like, well, clearly you have not read very carefully. But thank you. So, yeah, I did. It was all genial and civil, but I declared myself. I can think of some examples of people who are not as probably responsive to my arguments because of that, which is about polarization, which is one of the things we have to fight against. It's so complicated, right? Because you can't become what you behold, right? You can't become so partisan that the other person won't listen at all. I think one of the great underreported speeches in American history, which now that I'm talking about it, I should have put it in the book. Do you do that? I always do this. Like 3 days after something's published, I'm like, damn, I should have said that. Lyndon Johnson, in his last speech at his library in late 72, he was having a conference on civil rights. He died in January of 73, same day the court ruled in Roe, interestingly. And he said, telling a man he's wrong doesn't do you any good because he doesn't think he's wrong. And so, long-winded way of coming to answer your question, I think that my version of going to the streets is to tell a countervailing story. And I do argue by implication. I can talk for hours about President Trump and never mention the man's name.
When I say going to the streets, and I think it was clear to the people in Montgomery, I meant going to the streets like the original civil rights marchers,
yeah.
not so much like the weathermen of the 60s. But there is, to me, a danger. I mean, I thought that when Peter Paul and Mary sang Blowing in the Wind, it was beautiful and lyrical, and there was enough poetry there that they didn't have to be as explicit as, say, a guy whose music I love, Bruce Springsteen, who has written a very heavy-handed song called Minneapolis. It's not a great song. So is there a line that you have to tiptoe on before you become strident and screechy?
I think so. I mean, I think all of us know that. Do we learn more from sinners or from saints? We learn a hell of a lot more from sinners. And so I'm not going to cast a single aspersion on how other people have reacted to this moment. It is unsettling. In our larger non-nuclear family, we have a situation where ICE has detained someone without charge, who's a relative of someone whom we're very close to. And it's unsettling. And so I think that the best thing I can do is, for instance, to stay within the Montgomery example, I decided to write a short book about John Lewis when I was standing on the bridge in March of 2020, which was his last visit.
The Pettus Bridge.
Yeah. Sorry, in Selma. And it was fascinating because Congressman Lewis was back to his collegiate weight because of the pancreatic cancer. And so he looked rather like he did. And he said, a few years ago, some children of God walked across this bridge to shed a little blood in an attempt to redeem the soul of America. And I was standing there looking down at the brown water of the Alabama River, and the Pettus Bridge, you've been there, I'm sure, is way up there. You know, often when you go, as you know, when you go to these great sites, you know, they're much smaller. I remember going to the Battle of Hastings, and it's like your backyard. I mean, it's just like, oh my God. The Pettus Bridge is way up there. And so these folks felt isolated in more ways than one, and exposed in more ways than one. And I just was thinking on that Sunday morning, and it was about 3 or 4 days before COVID shut everything down. I remember thinking, this is the message. This is the antidote to this virus and the body politic that ebbs and flows. Yeah. And so that was my street action to write that little book.
Well, I think that in this anthology in which you, I should point out, this is not a children's book. This has got Alexander Stevens talking about what the Civil War is about in it. And it's got
George Wallace.
Nor is it slanted in one way. It's got Clarence Darrow taking apart William Jennings Bryan. But that was one way of doing it. I thought the other way that you did it, which was better than Mr. Springsteen, was the book on Lincoln. I thought that as I read that book on Lincoln, it wasn't just a great book on Lincoln, and it wasn't like every third paragraph you said, and in light of what happened on January 6th, this is really important.
Yeah.
Yet you could read that book and you could never escape the notion that you were saying something about today.
You are correct, sir, as Ed McMahon, the great Ed McMahon, once said. The point of that book was, if you send someone to the pinnacle of power with an interest in power as opposed to any moral mission of conscience, chaos results. And I'm not comparing myself to these people, but Arthur Schlesinger's Age of Jackson is kind of about the New Deal.
Yeah.
Right. And that unfolds throughout. And each book I've done actually has been, and I sort of explicitly do it. I don't know about you, and let me ask you this. I don't know how, when you decide on a subject, when you did Nixon, like, I don't know what was the impetus. I'd love to hear that. So in some ways, the impetus for my doing Andrew Jackson was George W. Bush was in the midst of what now seems to be a totally quaint expansion of executive power. You know, as W says, I look like Cicero now. And one of the most insightful notes I got about that book was from George W. Bush, who he wrote me as president, and he said, it's a handwritten note. As you might imagine, I am fascinated by presidents who use the tools of the office in moments of crisis. And I did Jefferson when there was a tall, cool, intellectual American president who pretended he didn't like politics, but was quite good at it.
So you finished Jackson. You're casting about
mm-hmm.
for the next person. You got the Pulitzer in your pocket, and you can basically do anybody, including doing people that have already been 10 biographies about. And did you say, well, this is a time where I should look for a cool Obama type figure? Or did you say, I would want to do Jefferson, and oh, you know what? As I do Jefferson, I can explore the idea about.
Yeah, it was the latter. That's a good distinction. It was the latter. My argument about Jefferson was, and this was a period, this was 09, 10, 11, 12. Tea Party's on the rise. People are attacking Obama as a Muslim. You know, there's somebody, I've forgotten his name, but he's doing a lot of birth certificate stuff.
Yeah, who is that guy?
I can't remember who that was. And part of my mission there, and it was a mission, was in a way, a friend of mine said this after he read it. He said, well, you're trying to redeem politics. And it was, you know, it was a moment of profound cynicism about the arena. You know, the people who had been so excited about Obama suddenly encounter reality. The right is moving sharply right. So choosing Jefferson, this will speak to several of our fellow members, maybe the initial reason, and then these other themes developed. The initial reason was Jefferson had been surrounded with David McCullough had a Louisville slugger and Chernow had a weed eater, and they had just gone after the guy. Right? I mean, Hamilton,
This is
Washington, and Adams,
an
right?
Adams,
These
yeah.
guys had just, they had killed a lot of trees and they'd made them all fall on Monticello.
Right. This is before Lin-Manuel, but not too much before.
Right,
Yeah.
right. And everybody was just killing him. And I was like, I mean, the guy wrote the most important sentence ever originally rendered in English. Let's take a look. I didn't know this at the time. I was writing in the same season. In fact, we published the same year as Annette Gordon Reed's landmark, amazing book, The Hemingses of Monticello. Parenthetically, Annette, whom I adore, has caused perhaps the most significant problem in my marriage. Now that's getting listeners to sort of sit
There's a
up.
soundbite.
There you go. I want you to use that. I've said this a lot around Annette, and she just rolls her eyes at me. The only nonfiction book, including those written by her husband, that my wife has read twice is The Hemingses of Monticello, and she loved it so much. And it really pisses me off.
It's, but think about it. How many books have been written by biographers that changed the whole story the
Yeah.
way that one did? I mean,
Oh,
she's.
she's, yeah, Annette's, what I like to say about Annette is she's both brilliant and nice, and that's really annoying. I'd prefer it was one or the other. So I thought, all right, this is a moment. Adams is in the conversation, Hamilton's in the conversation. I think Ron had just written, I think he had just published Washington. My timeline might be a little fuzzy, but I think that's right. And Jefferson was just a bloody pulp on the floor.
This after the statue came down in New York? I mean, had the was this after the Washington Post called him a rapist on the front page?
I
And there was
don't
a moment, yeah, it's tough
and
to remember the sequence of things.
and my argument, my whole theory of biography, which sounds very grand, is I don't begin from the perspective of why didn't they do more. I begin from the perspective of how did they manage to get so much done, given that we're fallen, frail, and fallible people. And so I'm doing Eisenhower right now, or actually, Eisenhower is doing me. This is the only place anyone would care about this detail. I am staring at a 1400-page manuscript that I feel like the German army. I'm being routed by Eisenhower. He's just killing me.
Two volumes, John, two volumes.
Oh my God! Well, you can't get people interested once anymore. But let me. I want to come back to, like, what was the rosebud of your doing Nixon, for instance?
Oh, that was just there was an editor at Doubleday who came and said to me, what do you think about Nixon? Why don't you go poke around? And she just is Chris Pappalo, and she just had this sort of feeling that the time was right, enough time had gone by. And then I went out there to the presidential library and found that in addition to the tapes, all these papers had been reviewed, and everybody thinking that Nixon had been done hadn't been looking at them. So,
As you went through it, how did your view of him change?
I think the book shows that. I think hopefully it's very empathetic about Nixon, the guy, and critical of parts of his performance as Nixon, the politician. But the thing I was happy about in the reviews was this shows Nixon with all the nooks and crannies and doesn't take the Fox News or MSNBC approach. Funnily enough, I don't think it sold as well because it didn't. I mean, I had a lot of liberal friends come to me and say, "Oh, I hear you wrote a great book about Nixon. Hate the bum, never going to read it." And I presume that on the right there were people like that as well. But it's tough because there's an argument that you can, especially in today's society, that you can sell more, you can be more successful by being strident.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a there's a difference between writing a tract and writing a biography. And I've written both, but never at once.
Well, let me ask about Lincoln, though. Same question. As you're contemplating looking at Lincoln, was it after January 6th and you said, "Oh my God, we're at a point here. This is like the Civil War. I got to do Lincoln." Or were you like, "I'm ready to do my Lincoln. What's the theme I'm going to use?"
It was a little, so it was, I decided to do it in 2021. So it would have been after the sixth. Part of it was I wanted to explore why he was anti-slavery. That is, what was the moral conviction? And Doris Goodwin, of course, had done The Great Political Book, and she covered this as well. So it's not a direct contrast at all. And that's a landmark book as well. I was not interested in how he did it. I was interested in why he did it. And I'm deeply interested in religion and how it affects or doesn't people. And the arguments about Lincoln's faith are fascinating. And so it was a way of maximizing the themes I was interested in. And it really wasn't about, oh, we're on the eve of another civil war. It was about the tension between conscience and power and what happens in a republic when power becomes more important than conscience. And so we are living, I would argue, in a Hobbesian moment and have since 2015.
Short, brutal, and content. Help me out here.
Nasty, brutish, and short.
Nasty, brutish, and short.
His state of nature was the war of all against all. And my native region, I'm a Southerner, we were so intoxicated by our racial, economic, cultural, and political grip that we blotted out the moral sun. And it was Lincoln who, with a political sensibility, insisted that power divorced from conscience was fatal to the American experiment. I mean, Lincoln was, he saw the Civil War, yes, as a war against slavery, but it was a war to redeem democracy. Could democracy work? And that was probably the scariest book I've done, just because of the volume of stuff. I want to say one thing about our mutual craft, if I may.
That's what this is for.
I've been doing this a long time now. I have never, without exception, if I've reached out to a fellow practitioner on these journeys, everyone has been collegial, generous, often way above and beyond the call. And I think there's an image of all of us that we're, in some sort of virtual faculty lounge stabbing each other. I have found it to be the opposite. Now,
Well,
people may hate me outside my earshot or whatever. That's fine, but I have found the world of biography and history to be incredibly collegial. And I'm thinking about Michael Burlingame, who knows more about Lincoln than Lincoln did. And just being able to, call him up, go see him, and have him be so generous. And there's so many, I mean, endless others. I just think that's, we should put that on the record. I have found us to be a very collegial guild.
I think it's just the work is so hard that you'd have to be a real SOB not to
Right.
try to help somebody who's drowning, reaching out to the raft with them.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
But now talking about the times that he was in and what you do and what you can do in the times that you're living in. I think Lincoln was fascinating because he, evolved, and he's criticized in the 1619 Project because he was not from the beginning anti-slavery, and he was brought along to it, and then all of a sudden he saw an opportunity, the way Jefferson saw an opportunity in Louisiana to do something really great and important, and he seized the moment. No?
I'm going to dork out on you for a second, if I
Sure.
may. He was always anti-slavery. And this was something Sean Wilentz taught me years ago. And I had not, I will confess, I had not really appreciated the nuances of the anti-slavery spectrum, that there were abolitionists, there were anti-expansionists, there were gradations within the movement. And the thing about Lincoln and the criticism of him, which comes from, I mean, it begins with Frederick Douglass to some extent. When I teach, I always make classes read Douglass's 1876 speech about Lincoln at the Freedmen's Monument, which is in this book. I think it's the most profound meditation on biography and history I've ever read. I mean, because it's Douglass says Lincoln was cold, tardy, and indifferent. He tarried long in the mountain. Great phrase. Douglass couldn't write a bad phrase. He's annoying too. But somehow our redemption met in this man in this moment. And so that goes back to what I said a moment ago. To me, the remarkable thing is not that he didn't move faster, it's that he moved at all. And maybe people will see that as lowering the bar. But if one appreciates the complexity of human nature, it is so hard to want to give as well as take, right? We've been doing this since the second chapter of Genesis, right? We've been taking instead of giving. And, the South clearly knew that Lincoln believed all this, because why would they have seceded immediately, right? South Carolina was out by the 20th of December. And it's a complicated story. It's one of my favorite, again, geeky things, is that wonderful, I think it was part of the Aaron Copland canon, that wonderful peroration of the 1862 annual message when Lincoln wrote, "We cannot escape history. This administration and this Congress will be remembered in spite of ourselves down to the latest generation. We shall either meanly lose or nobly save the last best hope of earth," right? Beautiful. You can hear Sam Waterston reading it, right? It comes at the end of a message that proposed a program of gradual compensated emancipation, and the compensation was going to the slave owners. And nobody really reads the first part of it.
Well, that's the way the British did it, though. And nobody, right now, everybody just says, "Oh, Amazing Grace." The British sang a song and then.
Yeah, I mean, the British paid. So the detail I love about that is the compensation for the slave owners for the British abolition was so large that the note was not fully paid off until 2015, literally, right? And so, and again, I'm a boring white guy, so I'm not being blasé about any of this. But if you put yourself, as we're supposed to do, if you put yourself in Lincoln's shoes, immediately after your election, you have William Seward and Charles Francis Adams and all these guys saying you should take this Crittenden Compromise. The secession winner is an amazing story. And Lincoln says no, because if he gives up the principle of no expansion, it's over. And so I think he was steadily anti-slavery. He waited for his moments. And I think if he had not done what he did, if, for instance, he had taken that deal in 1860, 61, which was such a popular deal that people, smart alecks like me who would have, been commentating at the time would have said, "Oh, this is the wise deal." Because what was America but a deal, right? I mean, this is what we did. Missouri, 1850. This is what we did. I think slavery would have lasted into the 20th century.
Wow.
I don't, the only time, I think I'm right about this, the only allusion to the 20th century I ever found in Lincoln's papers was in that message I just mentioned, where he was like Simpson Bowles, right? Like every Blue Ribbon Commission, he was putting off the day of reckoning. And the idea was that slavery would finally be gone in 1900. It was a 40-year plan. And Delaware almost passed it. It failed by a vote, a couple of votes. So I find, as I mentioned before, but as Arthur Schlesinger used to say, I do find self-righteousness in retrospect to be awfully easy.
Well, at the same time, Lincoln managed to go up to Gettysburg and throw together a little commentary about the Declaration of Independence, that first line, and what it really meant.
Changes American history in that speech. It's a fascinating political rhetorical trick Because you can argue, as John C. Calhoun did, you can argue that the Constitution, I mean, is there really not a right of revolution in the Constitution? Really? I mean, isn't the whole point that it was the result of that? He skips over the legal argument. He just jumps over 1787, takes us to the Declaration, and reorients the national story based on the document we're celebrating now, when the Constitution had a kind of primacy of place before then.
Yeah. Here's one of my favorite offbeat questions.
Yeah.
I go back and forth. Right now, I probably would say number one, but before we began this talk, I probably would have said Washington. But who's greater, Washington or Lincoln?
This is a trick question.
Because, no, you just got to just do Washington's presidency. You can't go to do the whole thing.
Oh, okay. So I can't do the not becoming a king.
Oh, you can do that, sure.
Okay. One should argue that his decision in the 1780s to accede to the Congress and the Articles of Confederation and not pursue monarchical authority was the single greatest decision in American political history, great in terms of selfless. Once he makes that decision, it is also true, if you really climb inside the Philadelphia minutes of the Madison and the Lansing notes about the presidency at the Constitutional Convention, it was really fuzzy. They weren't sure what to do. And I'm convinced that Madison was willing to roll the dice because he knew that Washington would be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And Washington proved himself.
Yeah.
So, yes, Washington makes the creation of the Republic possible in many ways. I think the human scale of a war that we now figure killed 750,000 people, when he could hear the cannons in Virginia, I think that was a more difficult task of statecraft. I mean, Washington had a lot of friends who could, you know, he had Hamilton, he had Madison, you know, he had the greatest cabinet ever. You know, he had help. And Lincoln really, when you think about the first couple of years of the war and the difficulty he had with military commanders, and, you know, that was a lonely task.
Yeah.
That was Pulitzer Prize winning biographer and historian John Meacham, talking with BIO member Jack Farrell in April of this year about his latest book, American Struggle, Democracy, Dissent, and the Pursuit of a More Perfect Union. It was published by Random House in February 2026, and next week we'll present the second half of this fascinating interview. To learn more about BIO, or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillengaines created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer. Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer, and Shireen Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonia Williams, and until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.